Welcome to KABU, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thanks, Jan.
Well, you've written extensively on national policy, militarism, nuclear disarmament, and the peace movement in books, articles, and through your work as co-founder and national director of Roots Action. You published an article earlier this year in Truthout titled, "Now is the Time for a Global Movement Demanding Nuclear De-escalation." I'd like to talk with you today about current organizing around the threat of nuclear war, but let's start first with your history of anti-nuclear activism in Oregon. Around this time in August 1977, you were part of a group of activists with the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance that occupied the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant on the Columbia River north of Portland. Can you tell us about that action and why that date was chosen?
Yeah, well, at that time, Trojan was the largest operating nuclear power plant in the country. And while there had been civil disobedience at some construction sites, this was the first time that people occupied, which is to say, in our case, blockaded the gates to an operating nuclear plant. And so the August 6th time, the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, seemed an appropriate timing for our action. We had many people gathering to plan nonviolence training and logistics and so forth. It was really a wonderful movement effort. Hundreds and hundreds of people engaged in the planning. As I remember, 80 or so people were arrested. There were follow-up protests and blockades, all nonviolent. We had several hundred people arrested. And it was an educational as well as agitational effort. So we learned a lot. I think we educated the people of Oregon and the Northwest a lot. And it was a step towards closure of that nuclear plant,
which did come years later. And then the tower was imploded in 2006. And much of that was an effect of the longstanding work of anti-nuclear activists. In your book, Made Love Got War, I love that title. You describe in some detail some of the planning and thinking behind civil disobedience as a strategy and how you spent 40 days in jail, and you reflect on that. Can you say a little more about why that strategy was important at the time?
Well, I think then and now it's part of the toolkit. One of the important aspects of how we can organize and hopefully bring about important social change, education, community organizing, legislative work, elections, protests, civil disobedience. This is sort of a rainbow of possibilities and necessities, I think, really. Often passivity wins the day, and we're acculturated to watch the news, to consume, you might say, history like white bread off the shelf. And if we're passive, we're really shafted. So I think sometimes civil disobedience, which has been true for really hundreds of years, and certainly the anti-war and civil rights movements in this country, it's an effective way to jolt people out of the fog that corporate media and conformity really create and perpetuate.
And later that year, I think it was November of 1977, there was a second occupation at Trojan where 122 activists were arrested and then were able to put on a choice of evil defense, also called the necessity defense, before a jury trial that argues that the threat of nuclear power outweighed the wrong of trespassing. Can you explain some how you made that argument in that the threat of nuclear power did not have that imminence that people associate with, you know, an imminent threat, because that's one of the criteria of using the defense. How did you make that argument with nuclear power?
Yeah, it's been called choice of evils or necessity defense or competing harms. You know, the metaphor is there's a big no trespassing sign in front of a house that's burning. You see a child in the attic trying to escape, you trespass. And that was a metaphor among many that we used because, yes, we were somewhat admittedly, sometimes not admittedly, trespassing, quote unquote. We were doing it to prevent a much greater harm, which was the threat to the Pacific Northwest and beyond of a potential meltdown from the Trojan nuclear power plant. So that was the argument made. There were a lot of convolutions that we were up in Columbia at the courthouse at trial, and many different aspects to how it unfolded in the courtroom. I have to say that it was done with a lot of integrity from the National Lawyers Guild attorneys who volunteered with the defendants. And Portland was sizable then, but not like it is now. It was late 1970s, and we had, whether it was channel whatever, we had dominance of the TV news for several days in the course of the trial, where we had expert testimony about the dangers of nuclear power. So we were, so to speak, educating not only the 12 on the jury, but many, many hundreds of thousands of people who are watching the news every night. And people may not remember, even if they were around then, the Oregonian was a fanatical pro-nuclear power newspaper. I mean, they just denounced us for protesting. They denounced our trial approach. And it just really freaked out the sort of pro-nuclear dinosaur folks who were at the time running the editorial pages of the Oregonian. Some things have changed since then, but that whole process of pushing the contradictions and educating and agitating, I think it's just as important now as it was then.
And you were also able, partly through the trial and through other legal strategies, to expose the history of Portland General Electric, covering over not only risks that might lead to a nuclear meltdown, but other kinds of risks associated with nuclear power.
Yeah, then as now, what they call IOUs, investor-owned utilities, they're just a disaster. I mean, this is part of predatory capitalism, which on a large scale is sort of a redundancy. You know, capitalism is by its nature predatory. It's trying to wring maximum profits out of people, while hell with the environment, hell with workers. And so that was the case. And of course, the names changed. The game is the same. It's not the same name of the utility in the Portland area and beyond, but it's the same problem. And so people who really care about social justice and the environment and protecting future generations, we have the same challenge ahead to expose the top-down sort of machinations for the profits of a few.
And false solutions to the climate crisis.
Yeah, we're getting those now. Of course, there's a new bill in Congress, which is a step forward. We're told Joe Manchin's cut a deal with Chuck Schumer and so forth. The fine print is not so good. And so these are false solutions being put forward. Hydrogen, this or that, all the above, which Obama started, this idea that energy is a cafeteria where you want to offer the menu of all options. So coal, oil, nuclear power, solar, wind. This is sort of the pretense, the umbrella under which Schumer has brought Manchin in. And it's a tough situation because we still have so much corporate dominance of the Senate and the House.
Another important aspect or argument of those actions was to show the relationship between nuclear power and the nuclear threat and militarism. Can you say a little about how you saw those links then and whether that's changed over time? Because the nuclear industry itself has really tried to distance itself from its associations with atomic weapons and nuclear weapons and the military.
Yes, the myth of the peaceful atom has been with us since 1945, and it was always a myth. Nuclear power came out of the nuclear weapons Manhattan Project. It's the same technology. The risks have fed off of each other.
In an article you published with Daniel Ellsberg last fall in The Nation, you make the point that discarding all ICBMs could be accomplished unilaterally by the United States with no downside, even if Russia chose not to follow suit. I mean, that's always the the argument, right, around the mutual assurance of destruction, or that the U.S. is locked in a death rattle with Russia but can't somehow escape it.
Yes, Daniel Ellsberg's book that came out a few years ago, and he was a nuclear war planner for many years. The title of the book is The Doomsday Machine, and he spells out what you're summarizing very well. And against the conventional wisdom that unilateral is a dirty word and makes people vulnerable, in fact, it would make us more safe to shut down ICBMs because of the peculiar aspects of what they are. As land-based, they're vulnerable to first strike, they invite it, and they destabilize the international arena. There's always the submarines and the airborne, so it's not as though the U.S. would be vulnerable about mutually assured destruction with the acronym of MAD. Speaking of MAD, Martin Luther King Jr. described what he called the madness of militarism, and we're there. And, you know, Oregon in recent decades has become more and more progressive. It's no longer a sort of purple state. And yet there's so much work to do to pressure senators and representatives from Oregon to do a much better job of challenging militarism. Often they don't do it at all. And so that comes from the grassroots to make the necessary changes.
And just, I'd like to close with having you say a little more about that, the role of activism and movement building as we try to incorporate this other horrifying threat of nuclear war with the climate emergency. And I know many activists, you know, are shell-shocked by the enormity of the threats we face. And so how do you speak to young activists who are trying to focus on the fossil fuel industry and all of the enormity of the threats we have to life on the planet, with now the additional threat of nuclear weapons and nuclear war? What would you say to these young activists?
One aspect I think we could focus on is that the military industrial media corporate complex wants us to be passive and discourages the only hope that we have, which is the avenue for people to become more aware and to be active and to be assertive. And when it comes to climate, one of the almost entirely hidden realities in the United States in discourse, including among progressives, unfortunately, is that the ultimate climate change is nuclear winter. And that if there is a nuclear war, agriculture is going to virtually disappear within a matter of months because of an extreme of climate change. So for young people who are, as they should be, extremely concerned about climate change, just imagine your worst scenario, climate change, in the next 100 years, telescoped into a few months. That's what nuclear war would do. And it's the same corporate forces that portend those kind of results. So we got to organize and we have to create change.
And in closing, how can listeners find out more about your work and just say a bit about Roots Action?
Well, I'd encourage people to join the network of Roots Action. We started with zero people 10 years ago. We now have 1.2 million. And you can take about 30 seconds to go to rootsaction.org and sign up at the top, just your email address, and then you'll get action bulletins. And my articles are frequently on commondreams.org, which I think is a very useful, valuable website in general. And if people want to track my particular articles, you can go to normansolomon.com. And I do want to say that a lot of the activism that was effective at the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant in the late 1970s was strengthened enormously by KABU. We had countless programs on KABU talking about the need to do nonviolent civil disobedience at Trojan. And KABU was one of the big reasons we were as successful as we were.
Well, thank you for that plug for KABU. We will continue to follow this work. And I think your point about how much thought and care and planning goes into coordinated nonviolent action is really important. And it is a way, too, of building forms of community and what some call prefigurative politics by how you come together and confront power.
For sure.
Well, thank you so much, Norman Solomon, for being with me today. And I look forward to you coming on again to the Old Mole down the road. I know you've been on our show before, so you're one of us.
Thanks very much, Jan.